My name is Ayrokhsh Faiz Qaisari. I was born in Northern Faria province. I've lived in Mazar-e Sharif after the Taliban regime. And I'm passionate about women's rights and seeing a day when gender equality will exist in Afghanistan.
Wonderful. Thank you for joining me today on RQ Adventures to talk about women in the region and the work you do with, is it called Sahar?
Sahar, yes.
And how you came here. So let's start back just growing up in Afghanistan and during that time, during the Taliban. What was daily life like for you growing up?
I have very little memory of before the Taliban regime. I remember a little bit about my first, second, third, and fourth grade. But I have a lot of, unfortunately, better memories from the Taliban regime when they actually came. And I come from a family where we are seven girls and one boy. So my parents always worked really hard, not just wanted my brother to get a good education, but also my sisters. You know, my mother wanted, she would probably be happy if we all became doctors. So at the time when the Taliban came, my brother and three of my sisters were in medical school in a different, in Mazar-e Sharif, where we live right now, because we didn't have medical school in our city. When the Taliban came, my sisters left out because they couldn't continue with their education. So my brother was still getting his education, but my sisters came back to where we were living. And my mother really wanted to do something to stand by with my father and help him out, because he was the only one who was working to financially help the whole family. So my mother started a secret school where she taught the kids in our neighborhood, some of our neighbors who also had their daughters who were staying home and couldn't continue their education. So we all got together, my sisters, older sisters, one of them would teach math, one would teach English, one would teach Daddy, and my mom would teach the Quran. That's how we lived for a while, using our books that we had from schools. But after a short while, they heard about our secret school, so they took my dad to prison because he was allowing his wife to get an education, and that was for them that was a big crime. I mean, it was a time when you couldn't go out without being accompanied by a male relative, and that had to be only your father or your husband or your brother. You couldn't even go out with your uncle. You had to be fully covered. If you went out without socks, that was a crime. So it was very difficult to see that. And luckily, we had neighbors. We had people in our neighborhood who knew my father and my parents and my mother, and they sent some of the elders in the community to where they had taken my father and tried to convince them that he was a good man, that his intentions were good. And so they released him only with conditions that he would no longer allow my mother to teach the girls in the neighborhood. That happened. Then we moved to Mazar-e Sharif because it was too much risky for our family with, you know, seven girls to be in that area anymore, because if, God forbid, something had happened to my father, we were there with no men in the family. So at least my mom said, if we go to Mazar-e Sharif, God forbid, something happens to your father, at least your brother will be there with us, another man. I don't know, when I think of those years, my childhood, I wouldn't want that to be repeated to anyone, not just children, but any woman, any human being, because only if you have lived those years, only you know how it is to live those years. Thinking about those years, I mean, I feel like that also was kind of like a lesson for me. Perhaps if that didn't happen, maybe I wouldn't have the same value for education. Those were the years when I actually started learning English, because my sister was my teacher and she taught me. She was my first teacher. Those were the years that I started learning about any other thing. We had books about the world. We would have, my sister would hold these competitions with the other kids in the neighborhood, and I would just work so hard, and I always wanted to take the first position in the competition. So some of those memories are fun to bring back. But to connect it to the work I do today with Sahar, I guess I Sahar, just to give you a little information, they were founded in 2001, and their main goal was to bring education and quality schools back to Afghanistan because of so much that had been going on during the wars, and a lot of the schools were destroyed by the Taliban. So they started in 2001, and specifically in Mazar-e-Sharif, where in northern Afghanistan, where the security has been very stable in the last 14, 15 years. I first heard about Sahar in 2012 when I was going. I was attending college at Juniata in Pennsylvania, and I went home for 3 months during my summer vacations. I heard that they were looking for an intern to work for them in Afghanistan, specifically in Mazar, where my family lives and where I was visiting them. So I thought that was a great opportunity. I worked for them for 3 months, visited all the schools they had built in very rural districts in Mazar-e-Sharif, and it was great to see their work, quality schools. I was very supportive of their work. When I came back, they had me fly in Seattle and speak at their fundraising event that year. And they were very happy with my work, that they wanted me to work again the next year if I went home to Mazar-e-Sharif. So I did that consequently for 3 years. And I love their work because by building schools, by giving them books, by giving them pens, by allowing girls to reach their best potential, the potential that they actually can and have, but they haven't had the opportunity, they haven't had the chance to step in a classroom and be able to hold a pen and write their names or the things they want to write about. And working with Sahar allows me to do that, allows me to at least prevent my childhood happening to other girls in Afghanistan, and I love that.
Wow, that's quite the story, but it all seemed like it, or experience to have lived, but it seemed like one thing led to the next. And,
yeah.
You know, so growing up under that kind of environment, was it, for everybody kind of in these neighborhoods, going from, sounded like quite an open system where women, you know, were going to school, actually becoming doctors and all sorts of different positions in society, suddenly that stopping. Was it something that for a lot of people was very foreign, or was there a lot of support for the Taliban and what they were doing at that time?
The system the Taliban had was so strict that, you know, for instance, if they saw one person stealing something, that they would cut their hands. People didn't have the courage to speak up. You just couldn't. You know, when every time my father had this little grocery store right next to our house, and there was a little door where we could just move back and forth from the grocery store to our house. Every time we knew that the Taliban were going to come and do a search in all the houses in our neighborhood, we had to hide our TV. We had this TV that we would just wrap it in a blanket and put it inside other blankets, and so that they wouldn't see if you had a CD, if you had a camera, if you had English books. You were out, like you were just out. So they were very strict people. It wasn't that people supported, it was just people were very scared, not just for their lives but for their children's lives as well.
Sounds like it was a very foreign, though, sort of thing for people to experience, when if everybody is having CDs and having TVs and normal, used to living this lifestyle and having women doctors,
yes.
And then something that has to go away. Because America, a lot of people sort of think of that region as being naturally very conservative,
and
when it's not.
It's not. It's absolutely not. I mean, when my mother talks about hers, years of going to school, I mean, people were very open to any kind of development, you know. Women were driving, women were doctors, women were formed more than 50% of the workers in the government. It was very open, there were fashion shows, you know, there were a lot of tourists or designers who would come from European countries to Afghanistan, you know, holding fashion shows in Afghanistan. So it was very foreign, it was totally different. I mean, I remember my first grade, I had this short dress, and I mean, I still remember the design of my dress. We know there was very good educational system. every Friday we would go to a radio show and sing songs. That never happens anymore in Afghanistan. I remember we would be so energetic. We would go in the morning, and in the evening, all the girls from our neighborhood would sit together in one house and listen to the songs that we sang at the radio. It was very foreign. Afghanistan had never been the way that media portrays it today, which unfortunately in some areas it's true.
Yeah.
But it was totally different before the Taliban came and the Mujahideen.
Which is so sad. How are things now there on the ground? Like, how are things working out? Is it getting better? Is it getting worse? Are more girls getting back into school? Are you seeing progress?
There are definitely more girls in school these days. I mean, I know that there's a lot going on in the media about Afghanistan going back, especially after the withdrawal of most of the American troops from Afghanistan in last year. From zero girls in school in 2001, we have more than 3 million girls in school today. So that's a
huge,
significant change. And I that makes me happy because this is just the start. And I think after these girls who have been going to schools since 2001 are growing up to become teachers, doctors, engineers. And I think these are will be the mothers who will make sure their children will go to school. So I expect to see a big rise in attending girls in schools. And I think just to give another fact there, that more than 50% of the Afghan population are under the age of 25. So imagine if we educate that part of the generation. It's the change is going to be unexpected. I think our generation holds everything for the future of Afghanistan. I'm very positive. I'm very, very hopeful for and what we hold in our stores for the future of this country. And I think Afghanistan deserves a better future.
Oh, absolutely. And so, just out of curiosity, to kind of go back, how did you end up finding out about this program that brought you to study university right in the U.S.?
Yes. So the first time I came in the U.S., it was in 2006. I came as an exchange student through this program funded by the State Department. It was called YES, the Youth Exchange and Study. 40 students came from Afghanistan. We were 20 girls and 20 boys. I was placed in San Diego in California. I did my 10th grade. It was an amazing year. It was a life-changing experience for me. I improved my English, did a lot of community service. We were supposed to do 18 hours, and I did. And they told us if you did more than 100 hours, you'd get some kind of a appreciation letter from George Bush, who was the president at the time. And I did more 120 hours. So I had to make sure that I was was chosen the best student of the year. Went back with so many great experiences and lessons that I took all the positive things I had learned from here. Went back to Afghanistan and started teaching, volunteering as an English teacher. I taught a lot of kids until I graduated from high school. Then I had a few friends who had come here to pursue their higher education, specifically their bachelor degrees, through this program called the Initiative to Educate Afghan Women, IEAW. I asked them about the program, and they told me the procedures, so I applied. Took about a year for all the steps and procedures, and that's how I ended up coming to the United States and Juliana College, where I got my bachelor's degree in international politics and peace and conflict studies.
And that's when you connected with Sahara while you were there studying.
Yeah.
And then that brought you to Seattle.
That brought me to Seattle.
To work with them.
Yes.
Wow. What a great program, though.
It's an amazing program.
To offer in Afghanistan. And,
specifically for women.
Which is so crucial, too.
Yeah.
You know, be able to give women those opportunities.
Yeah, I think we do need potential, quality, educated, strong female leaders in Afghanistan, and
well,
I think this program is doing that, just that job.
And I can't remember which newspaper it was in, but the president, Afghanistan's president wife, first lady, was yes. voted one of the most influential women or influential people.
Yes, I saw that too. Yeah,
I thought that was very.
I think she's doing a great job, and we just—I don't know if you heard about it or not—but recently they just announced that they would, with her help, they're trying to build a women's university in Kabul, which I think would be.
Oh, that's great!
Such a great initiative and step towards. Building a better future for African
women. Absolutely, and a place that will focus on women's education and making a headway for all the years that have been lost. Well, that's so exciting. And so obviously then that grew into your passion, your love for helping women and getting women's education. And so what's your reaction here in the States when you share this with people, you know, where you're from and Afghanistan and that you're really passionate about bringing women's education here? Kind of what's that been like?
Well, as you know, there's always stereotypes, both in Afghanistan and in the United States.
Absolutely.
So a lot of people, like you said, have that generalized idea about Afghanistan where women are oppressed, where women, I don't know, for some reason they look at Afghanistan as a representation of just how the other Arab world is, like Saudi or other countries where, for instance, women are not allowed to drive. But Afghanistan is totally different. Afghanistan has never been like Saudi. Our constitution is totally different, especially when it comes to women's rights. Women have the rights for a lot of things, for education, for equality, for jobs, for if they want to drive, they can. It's just the thing that what we lack in Afghanistan is the security and opportunities. If women are given the opportunities, if they reach their potential to reach to those opportunities, I think no one can stop women. And we have been fighting throughout Afghanistan's history where women in Saudi are not even allowed to raise their voice. We can, and we have been. When the mob killed Farhunda in Kabul a while ago, women went there and they carried her body, and no one could stop them. They raised their voice. They talked to the government. They held them accountable. They made committees where they could go and investigate about this case. So here that's the kind of reactions I get. But I try to talk to them. And telling them that Afghanistan has never been the way that you see in the media today. And it's not. There is a part of Afghanistan, there are some parts, specifically in southern Afghanistan and eastern Afghanistan, where the security is not doing very good. And there, yes, the explosion does happen sometimes, but there are also a part of Afghanistan that also has another phase where people have normal lives. There are, you know, women are going as teachers. Women have jobs where they are heads of radio stations, where they're reporters, they're journalists. That there's also a normal phase that Afghanistan has, where you know children can go and play out and go to school and feel like the normal life like people do here in the United States, which people don't see. I sometimes when I get in too much arguments, I send them the link to my documentary, Look Who's Driving, and they see it and the questions I get, sometimes it's shocking. For instance, you have roads in Afghanistan, like paved roads? I didn't know Afghanistan wasn't like Saudi. I thought you guys weren't allowed to drive. No, that's not true. We can do whatever we want. It's just that the media has put so much negative news in people's minds that it's just difficult for them to see that or just do a little research on their own and see the real face of Afghanistan.
I guess so true. So Look Who's Driving. What's the documentary about? People can go check it out.
So it's about myself getting my driver's license in Afghanistan. I guess I worked as a filmmaker for a year. There was another program we did with the U.S. Embassy in Kabul where they would bring filmmakers from the United States and they would train us to make documentaries, feature stories. So we were 15 people from all over Afghanistan. At the end of the year, they gave us our last assignment, which was to make a documentary. They said, among the 15 of you guys, the 4 best will be chosen to go to this film screening in London. So everyone worked really hard, and I wasn't sure what to do. I really wanted it to be something about women, because I was a woman, and I really, really wanted it to be. Because if it had the opportunity to go to London, I wanted it to be something positive about my country. Because people already had negative news about Afghanistan. I wanted it to be something positive. And at the time, I was taking the driving course in Afghanistan. I really wanted to get my license and start driving. So I filmed myself, since my sister was also taking the course with me. Sometimes she would film me, sometimes I would film her. Sometimes we had someone who came over from Kabul and helped with the film. So I made the film, and it was very successful. It has, you know, it has happy moments, it has funny moments, and it has moments from when I talk about my childhood. It actually was chosen as one of the best.
Really? So, I was going to ask.
So we went to London. But before I came to start my college here in Pennsylvania, we went to London and screened the film, and it was a great time.
And so how can people watch it?
It's actually on YouTube. Okay. Called Look Who's Driving.
On YouTube. And I will also include the link in that around the podcast and on the blog so people can access it that way. Well, so you're a filmmaker as well.
Yes, I have a little filmmaking side to my system too, yeah.
That's so neat. That's so cool. Do you want to do more films?
I would like to. I actually have made a few films. That's another part of my job with Sahad. When I did my first internship with them in Mazar, I did a short film, and that's what I screened when I came to their first annual fundraising dinner here. And we had another film last year. Since I've shot a lot of films from my visits in different schools and took a lot of pictures, I use those to make short films when it comes to reporting to our donors and writing about the outcomes of our projects in Afghanistan. So,
The video medium, films, is so powerful.
It is very powerful.
Films and photography, I think, are so powerful in telling stories and changing people's perspective, showing them how it's different than they imagine. Because words, your mind can fill in all sorts of blanks. When you actually see someone driving, or women doing things you didn't expect, or countries that look different than you would imagine. I remember the first time I went to Islamabad, and it looks just like Bellevue. Parts of it, you know, big leafy boulevards and the lake and mountains and trees.
Pakistan, usually people don't even think of that.
Oh, and it's very affluent, obviously, Islamabad is, because that's where all the financial center is. Wealthy people look completely different than I had ever thought. And then I realized I'd never seen a picture of it.
Yeah.
And you get all these ideas in your head.
Indeed, videos and pictures speak so much, especially, you know, their life, and when people get to see the face of those people who are, you know, especially with our reports when it comes to talking about what we've been doing, you know, hearing from these girls who are going to these schools, what it means for them to be able to go to a school where, compared to when they didn't have a school to go to, hearing the girls' voice and seeing their faces on videos, it really makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm. And so, as you work with Sahar, they're building schools. Do they focus more on like the quality of each school and really like spending a lot of time? Or are they constantly trying to expand and bring in more schools?
We focus on quality education. It's not as much as the number of schools, but more how we can keep, when we build a school, how we can keep the girls in school. Because with a lot of the schools we've been building, there's a big increase when you start the school, but when girls get into 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, there's a big dropout, because that's when a lot of girls are getting engaged, they're getting married, and because they take all these other responsibilities in their households, they cannot continue their education. So right now we're focusing on bringing tools to help these girls stay in school longer, at least graduate from high school. We got a few grants from a few foundations here in Seattle to be able to hold workshops and trainings for the girls in 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th grade, and helping them understand and explain what it means to be a young mother, or how it is to not be able to graduate from high school or end up being a single mother, and compare that to mothers who are actually educated and are able to get jobs and be able to support their families financially and not be dependent on their fathers or brothers or other relatives. So we hope that that will affect, keep our girls longer in schools. So,
and what kind of community support, right? Do you find certain areas are you're able to more easily get the communities and the families behind keeping the schools, the girls in schools versus other areas? Or is it pretty uniform? Or are there certain specific challenges around getting kind of the family and community to get behind this important idea of keeping the girls in school when it's more customary for them to get married younger?
So, yes, that does depend on what part of the town the school is located. In central parts of the town, where, like in bigger cities, it's much easier. And most students do get to graduate from high schools. The rural areas, that's a little difficult. That's when girls get engaged and get married quicker than the girls in the cities. And again, that's because most of those girls in the rural areas don't have educated parents. If they had an educated mother or a father, they would know the value of education and know what it would mean for their daughters to be able to graduate or get a job or become a doctor or a policewoman that she wants to. So for those parents, again, girls cannot fight back. They don't know how to fight back. They don't know how to convince their parents, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to help them understand and say, this is what you can tell your parents, or when you have someone who has come to ask for your hand, at least you can, you know, speak up for yourself and give logical reasons for your parents to help you stay longer in schools.
Have you seen any one or two or maybe multiple ideas, but is there something that's been particularly effective in helping those girls translate that idea to either their family or their future husband or whatnot that they need to stay in school? Has there been something that's been particularly useful in helping convince those families that it's worthwhile to have their daughters stay?
I think so. Before we start our this kind of a program, we talk to the community, we talk to the principals of those schools and say, is this something that you would be interested in? Is this something that's okay for us too? Because we want to make sure that it's okay for with the community, that they're not thinking we're interfering in their lives. So unless they agree with it, unless they give us the permission, we don't actually do it. So the fact that they've actually agreed to having such kind of a workshop for their girls and daughters, that already it's a step, because they're saying we're open to having your girl learn these tools and be able to, and we're agreeing that it's important to continue for our daughters to continue their education. One of the examples from the reports we've been getting from us are that we have some girls who come to these trainings with their children. They're in high school, they're already married, they still want to come because they want to be a better mother. They want to make sure that if that happens to their children, that they don't allow that to happen, that they would make sure that their children will get to graduate from high school before they're married. So I think that itself shows that it's been very effective.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
But then I guess also probably raises a whole new set of challenges that you've got young mothers coming in and you've got it. But it's exciting that they want to, you know, they want that so bad that they're willing to kids with them and they want to learn and gain as much access as they can. So what about advances in technology? Has this made it easier? Or have there been things that you've been able to leverage to help especially in these rural areas, maybe don't have access to a lot of, you know, they can't get on the World Wide Web, the Internet, and look things up or study themselves. Have you found any kind of, or does Sahar use any sort of online tools or things as ways, so maybe a girl can't go to a class, but if she has access to something online, she can self-teach herself?
That's a great question. Actually, we are so along with building schools, and we manage a teacher training center where we train teachers for rural villages, because in a lot of these villages, parents tend not to send their girls to school because they don't have enough female teachers. So we're trying to train female teachers to have enough teachers for these villages so that girls can continue to go to school. On that side, we also have computer centers. When we build a school, we also build a computer center for these girls. And we hire a teacher who goes there every day for an hour and teaches the girls how to use computers. I mean, some of these girls, they have never seen a computer in their life. They've never touched a computer in their life. So just to learn how to start a computer, how to type, how to use Microsoft Word. So we start with basic programs like Paint, Microsoft Word, Microsoft Excel. And right now we're actually working on bringing some kind of a coding program, so helping girls have the basic computer science. Mm-hmm. Our girls will go through this basic computer learning program, and then among those girls who are most passionate about learning advanced programs, those who want to become computer programmers, or we have girls who say, I want to develop programs for women in Afghanistan. So we're going to focus bringing in those strong, passionate girls and helping them learn how to code. So
that's so cool. We can solve the U.S. problem with lack of women in coding. I just imported them all from Afghanistan.
Yeah, technology, I think it's great and it's very powerful, and we hope to bring that.
And that's one thing I think that's been unique about the time we live in, is that because of the accessibility that the web opens up to access people anywhere, I mean, I'm sure you've been seeing, I've been seeing women, especially in the Middle East and North Africa, in the greater MENA region, being able to start companies, have all this access, teach themselves things, solve problems from their home or from within, taking care of their family, within a structure that maybe wouldn't normally have given that before. Like they're taking care of their kids, but they're also starting a company online and becoming very successful. Like there was a woman in Saudi Arabia who started a line of fashion forward headwear and sold them on Instagram and is doing incredibly well.
Yeah.
And she might not have ever had that kind of access without the internet, and it's created all these women entrepreneurs because it works within, especially in conservative parts of countries like Saudi Arabia, where women maybe don't have access to go to places or computer labs, but from home they can access the entire world.
Yes, and I know it's very powerful. I know a few girls. There's a woman called Farishta who's from Herat province in Afghanistan. She got her master's degree in computer science in Germany, and she returned back to Afghanistan. Now she has her own nonprofit where she's helping other girls. She's teaching them how to code. So it's
exciting.
Exciting.
It's opening so many doors. And
that's what happens when you help educate a woman.
Yes.
That they educate others, and I think that's what we need right now.
Absolutely, and I think it's such important, crucial work. So for folks who are listening, and who, let's say, two-part question. So first, if they want to help out women, they want to help Sahara, they want to, or any other programs or organizations you can recommend for people thinking, I want to get involved in some way, what can you recommend in terms of organizations they can get involved in, things they can look into? And then second part, people that want to learn more about Afghanistan, where would you send them? What are some good resources for them to kind of get a better picture of the country?
First of all, I guess for your first question, I would say, even if those who cannot contribute or get involved, I think just raising awareness. Even though if we can't do anything, the least we can do is raise awareness. And if we don't know about the country we're talking about, we can do some research. If they want to learn more about Saha's work, they can get on our website, sahareducation.org. They can reach us and write to us, and we will be more than happy to get in touch with them and to talk to them and let them know about the projects we're involved with. Those who want to learn more about Afghanistan, I would say don't always depend on the media that are talking the negative about Afghanistan. I would say get in touch with people. The best thing is having just conversation with people who are from those countries. And from my experience speaking to those people who've had a negative mindset about Afghanistan in my college years, it's just, the outcome has been amazing. Just talking to them and telling them, I'm from Afghanistan and this is the kind of life I had. And, a lot of the students have told me, I didn't even know, like, how is that possible? But you laugh and you're so normal and you're so nice. How is that possible? I didn't think people from your world would be nice people. So I think just having conversation with people like is a big step in learning other cultures and other countries.
Absolutely. I think that's why it's so important for people to travel or even just meet people in their own backyard and to also ask that question, what was it like, you know, in Afghanistan? I think a lot of times people can be a little shy too or feel uncertain. But like you say, ask and you'll probably find out the person is a lot more like you than you would think.
Exactly.
Are different. That's one thing when I travel, I'm always amazed at how similar people are. Even if I'm somewhere so far from home, at the end of the day, we generally are a lot more similar than different.
We're all the same.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today and our audience. I'm sure everyone's going to learn so much about Afghanistan and, you know, your interesting story of growing up and then all the great work that you're doing. I will include all the links that we talked about today so people can also easily find those.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, on all your next endeavors.
Thank you so much.